test. This will be an interview with Jacob Chinook on August 16th, 1985, at his home in Miami Gardens, Florida. Test, test. Okay. So just, why don't you tell me a little bit about your background again? You were born in the capital of Lithuania, is that right?
I was born in the city of Vilna, which is the capital of Lithuania.
And what year was that, can I ask?
Yeah, 1900.
1900. And you had how many children in your family?
We have two children.
So you had one brother?
Brothers?
Yes.
No more.
How many people in your family then?
At that time?
Uh-huh.
There were four.
Four. And your father was a, what was his occupation? Or
he was a millinery worker.
But you were brought up mostly by your grandfather,
right,
as you were telling me. So yeah. your father had come to the United States first, and then he
yeah.
went to Israel,
That's
or to
right.
Palestine,
to
as
Palestine.
It was at the time. So you said your grandfather was a teacher?
Yeah, he was a Hebrew teacher.
And he also did carving in his spare time, is that right?
While he was teaching the children, he was sitting at the head of the table and with a little penknife and doing carving.
And what sort of things did he carve? You were telling me.
Oh, whatever came up to his mind. Animals most of the time.
Animals and you said that he taught you how to do some carving yourself, is that right?
That's right. Yes. He was teaching me how to do it. And when I got myself a little penknife, I started doing it.
And about how old were you when you started carving? Do you remember?
Yeah, I think the first thing I made is a chessmen set. I was about 8 years old.
And you carved that with a penknife?
Right.
Do you remember what kind of wood it was?
Yes, it was two kinds of wood, from an apple tree and from a pear tree. And the color of them were two different colors. The apple tree was lighter wood, and the pear tree was darker wood. And that's why I made a chesset of two different colors.
Now, had your grandfather made, he hadn't made chess sets.
No.
He just made the animals. And
that's right.
And you said he sometimes made...
He made most of them snuff tobacco boxes.
Oh, I see.
For snuff tobacco, and he used to give it out as presents.
And would he carve them, the boxes?
Yeah, he used to carve it out of wood, make a little cover, and give it out to somebody, a present.
And so... Have you kept on carving? You were carving as a small boy just for fun, and then...
Just for fun. And then, because I had a younger brother and a younger sister, I used to make toys for them.
Oh, you used to make toys. What kind of toys?
Oh, like a sled for winter time and a little wagon for summertime and things like this.
But... That would involve more carpentry work, wouldn't it? Are you talking about rather than just carving?
Well, it's about the same in relation to each other.
And did you go to school in Lithuania when you were there? No.
There was no school for that.
So you were taught by your grandfather?
Right.
And did you go to a yeshiva?
I started to do that in the city of Vilna. But then I had to come back in the small town where my mother was with the children to help her getting along because my father couldn't send the money during the wartime.
And what did your mother do things with her hands also, or was
Yes, she did. She used to dye cotton for the peasant women. They used to come on Sunday to church. They used to leave the cotton in my mother's house, and they used to go to church, and she dyed for them different colors.
I see. And then, how old were you when you first went to Palestine, right, with your father?
Yeah, I was 19 years old.
And And prior to that time, had you started working in an occupation?
Oh, yes.
What was your occupation?
I had to work because during the war, my father could not send any money. Even letters we couldn't get. So what I did, whatever it was possible, and I helped making rafts and the river, and the wood was sent to Germany. So in order to do that, you have a lot of men, and everybody has a certain part to do. And when the rafts are ready, they take them all the way to Danzig.
I see. And you didn't do any working like welding or anything like that till
no.
you came to the United States.
No.
Is that right?
That's right.
So you went to Palestine in 1919, is
right.
that what you said? And then
right.
you worked briefly there and didn't like the British.
That's right. That's correct.
And so then you came, and your sister was in Brooklyn, is that right? And you wrote her, and
She was in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Springfield, Massachusetts. And you wrote her and came to...
And I wrote her a letter, and I asked her to please send me papers, because I don't want to stay there. I want to come to America.
And
she did.
What year did you come to the United
23.
States? 1923.
Yeah.
And you settled first in Springfield with her, did you?
In Springfield first. I came to my sister. And the next week I went and I got myself a job to learn how to do body and fender work.
I see. And that was in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And had you been carving all along just in your spare time?
In the spare time, yeah.
Did you bring any of those pieces with you when you came to this country, or were they all left behind?
All left behind.
So you learned how to do welding and worked in a body shop.
That's right.
And when did you, and then you got married and eventually moved to Brooklyn, is that right? And when did you begin working with metal and doing the kinds of sculpture pieces?
Right when we came back from Wilmington, Delaware, where I was working for the government at that time, helping to build minesweepers. And I did the work in the engine room, welding copper and brass pipes. And when the war ended and we came back to Brooklyn, that's when I started thinking of what happened to the 6 million Jews in Europe. We start getting news from the newspapers and otherwise, and we heard about the Holocaust, and it was in my mind all this time, and I figured that the American people, especially the young people, will never know how the 6 million Jews lived, how they worked, how they prayed to their God, how they were dressed, and so on and so on. So I started making statues to look like them.
Had you done any drawing before?
No.
No.
I make everything from my mind. I know them. I know all the people. Even now, I always can see them like in the front of my eyes. And I don't need no pictures.
But you said you were drawing sketches, right? Before you first started making drawings, is that what you meant?
No, I didn't make no sketches. I didn't make no drawings. I just made the statues.
Oh, the statues is
yeah.
what you said.
Yeah, not sketches, but statues.
And had you seen anyone do something like this before, or were you just sort of self-taught in learning how to... You know,
oh yes.
Build your skeleton.
Yeah, no, yes. In the studio where I started working on it, there was a man by the name Mr. Gamson from Chicago, and he was a great sculptor, and he did this, and I worked with him.
And this was in New York, right after World War II?
No. That was here in Miami.
Okay, but when you started first doing your figures, those were in wood. Those weren't in metal, is that right?
Yeah, those was in wood. That was a wooden statues I made, and plastic wood.
So your very first pieces were made out of wood,
out
right
of wood.
After World War II.
Right.
So that was the same sort of thing that you've been doing all along, but you started doing, your themes had changed, is that right?
Right.
You'd been making figures because you'd made chess sets and so forth.
Right.
So, but prior to that time, you'd done no carving of scenes of the old country.
I did of the old country, but out of wood.
Out of wood.
Yes.
But you said that you first, after World War II, when you started doing themes like this of the old country, because you heard about the Holocaust and wanted people to know about it.
Right.
Was that out of wood. That was the first time, though, that you started making figures that had to do with the old country. You'd been carving before, right?
Yes. But that's what I started right away, making them to look like the Jewish people before the Holocaust,
mm-hmm.
and dressed like the Jewish people, everything.
What was the first piece that you did right when you started this, doing pictures or carvings of Jewish life? Do you remember the first one that you did?
Yeah, the handkerchief dance was the first one.
The handkerchief dance.
Yes.
And that one, the original one, was made out of wood.
Out of wood.
And are they people that you know, for example, that are in your mind when you do this, or is it just scenes?
They were all people that I knew, and I made them look like them.
So when you look...
I made the water carrier just exactly the way he was,
so there was
alive.
So there was a man that you knew who was a water carrier?
That's right.
And
yes.
And do you remember his name?
I don't remember his name
but
anymore.
But you have a picture of him.
Right, I have a picture in my head the way he looked like.
And the handkerchief dance, there's a couple that are a model for that also, or?
No.
No.
That I know from history.
I see. So you never saw that particular dance in your...
Yeah, I seen them dancing like that, but I didn't do a particular couple. I made it just average.
Now, the klezmer musicians that are here, are those a particular...
Yes, I would say they're all exactly the way I saw them. They used to come on a horse and wagon to the town. There was maybe two or three weddings waiting for them. And we were little boys at that time, and they used to play in practice before the wedding, and we used to stay near the window and listen.
And there was always a violin player and a cello player.
These three people, yeah.
And a flute player.
Right, correct. And after they got through with the weddings that were waiting for them, they used to go in another town and do the same thing.
And then some of the other themes that you were showing me, some of the pieces, well, your earliest pieces that were in wood, are they... did you later repeat, since I haven't seen the wooden one, have you done the same thing over again in metal later on? Or?
Some was repeated and some was not.
Tell me about some of the pieces that are on display at the B'nai B'rith Museum, is that right, in Washington now? Can you describe to me some of the themes of the ones that are there, for example?
That's right. I can I can describe them. The first one that I made was a cheder. That's a Jewish school where they teach them the Bible and to pray and so on and so on. So it was a cheder, a rabbi sitting at the head of the table and children around the table. That was the first one. And then was a water carrier. And then was the handkerchief dance. And then there was a man leaving the wife and children and going to America. And there was a man blowing safer. and it was 40 pieces altogether, including up to a wedding, like a chuppah, and the groom, and the bride, and the rabbi, and so on.
So it's a whole group
a
of
whole group.
Pieces
yeah.
having to do with the wedding.
Right.
So those are coming back. They've been there for 5 years, you said?
Yeah. I have pictures of them. I have albums.
And do you have any particular works that are sort of autobiographical about your family? You were showing me the three boys going to school.
Yeah.
Is that the only one, or
That's the only one.
And you were the older brother.
Right.
And your younger brother didn't want to go, is
that's
that right?
Right.
He wanted to play with his ball.
Right.
Right. Are there any ones that you've done, like of your grandfather then, or any?
No.
No?
No.
They're just, that's the, but just neighbors or people then that you remember?
That's right. They were all like relatives.
Relatives.
All the people in the small town that we lived were considered like knowing each other and like relatives.
So then you were starting to tell me before when you made the switch from wood to metal.
Yeah.
That happened when? What year?
Already, when we moved into Miami.
Which was how long ago?
About 15 years ago.
So what, 1970 about?
Right.
And you came here to retire after
right.
working, you were a welder and worked
right.
in Audibody. And,
right.
And so then what gave you the idea to begin working in metal instead of the wood?
Well, because I knew to work with a torch and I liked that. And I thought that will be the best way to preserve it.
Mm-hmm. So you said that there was a sculptor that...
There was another one from Chicago. And he was doing it also in metal.
So he was the one who gave you the idea of how to begin making the pieces, is that right, by using those...
No, I made it already before he came in, because he used to come only summertime to Miami, and then he used to leave back for Chicago. But I did that before, and I kept on doing it after.
So in other words, you sort of taught yourself how to make the pieces in metal as you had made them in wood.
Right.
So the... What is again what you were calling the copper-coated...
welding rods.
Welding rods. And you make a skeleton
right.
out of those. And that's a procedure you've never seen anyone else do those? You
no.
You created that
no.
yourself. And you keep putting more and more wires till you can weld them
right.
together and make an arm or a leg or a face.
That's right. That's correct.
And you said that the texture of the surface will depend on... The heat?
The movement of the torch and the heat.
So you've experimented over the years with
that
how
side.
To do...
That side.
And what most of your pieces are have a textured finish rather than a smooth finish. Is that just something that you prefer?
Yeah, that's what I prefer better.
And we were talking before about the color, and you chose black...
Black because it's iron, it's steel.
It's steel and you wanted it to look...
Realistic or something like that.
And about how many of these pieces would you say that you've done in your lifetime? Do you have a sense of...
In my lifetime altogether, wood and metal, all of them?
Yeah, I guess that's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, over 100.
And do you have a particular favorite?
Nothing particular.
And you?
I like all of them.
And you've had a number of exhibitions here in Miami.
Oh yeah, I had a lot of them, but then I gave it up. It became too hard for me, because you have to carry every piece down to the car, and then from the car to the place of exhibition, and then wait there a whole day and then bring it back. Too much work.
Mm-hmm. You were telling me before that you were one of the first sculptors to deal with Jewish themes that, you know, there weren't that many statues or sculptures on the market that were dealing with the Jewish themes before Fiddler on the Roof. Is that what you were telling
me? I think so, because even in the newspapers in here, they always call me the sculptor of the shtetl.
I see. And so you had not seen anyone else doing pieces like this and these sort of themes?
No, I didn't see it. There may be people that are doing it, but I didn't see it.
So when you began, you were telling me that someone had seen your work and they wanted to make copies of it for reproductions, for sale.
Yeah, that's one of the partners of Austin Production.
And that's a firm in New York?
Mr. Green, yeah.
In New York?
In New York, in Brooklyn.
And do they deal, they don't deal exclusively with Jewish themes, it's with
sculptures? No, they have all kinds.
So they've made reproductions of how many of your works were you telling me?
Six.
Six.
Six pieces of mine.
And it was for 20 years that...
Right, that they were doing it.
And now they've stopped.
That's right.
And then locally, you've had exhibitions in the at the Jewish Federation. Tell me some of the places that you've exhibited locally.
Or in different malls, like in the Sky Lake Mall.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had in temples, like Temple Emmanuel for 4 weeks. And I had in Temple Menera. And I had in different occasions, I don't remember it offhand.
Have you had any people who have come and studied with you? You know, how to, you know, sort of apprentice themselves to you to learn how to do the same sort of thing that you
No, did? I never wanted it because I didn't have the time for it. You would have to waste a lot of time for it.
How long will it take you to make a particular piece?
Well, if it's only one person, it takes about a month. But if the statue consists of a group or more than one person, it takes longer.
Explain to me, like, the process you go through, say, from the beginning to the end when you're doing a piece.
Yeah.
I mean, what sort of things do you do? Do you first get an idea in your mind and how?
Yeah, first I make up my mind what I want to make. And then I make a start with the wires, and little by little it becomes a figure.
And are there any themes that... things that you have that are sort of partially finished or things that you'd, you know, like to do if you could now of, you know, different themes that you haven't...
I made different, some of them different. I made like David and Goliath.
David and Goliath?
That was one. And then I made... I made Moses carrying the tablets. Then I made the Jewish prophet, Jesiah, where he said, someday there will be no more wars, it will be all peaceful, and so on, so on. Then I made another one. I sold it to a professor. It was Rabbi Hillel and the one... the Roman that came and said he wants to learn to become a Jew if you can teach him to be as you while he stands on one leg. So Rabbi Hillel told him, don't do to others what you wouldn't do to yourself. And this is the basic thing. After that, you have to study the Torah.
So you've done sort of themes from the Bible,
right,
from the writings of...
All of them, from themes from the Bible.
And have you ever done commissions for people, or have it all been things that you yourself just wanted to do, and then people have bought them?
Well, I done one. They wanted to give somebody a present at a banquet, and they wanted to have this generation and the young generation. So I made one that was on the holiday of Sukkot. He was praying with a Nesrik, that's a Jewish thing, and he was teaching this to his grandson. So that was two generations. So they gave that to a present to some kind of a professor.
But you haven't really sold very many of your pieces, is that right?
No.
You're not interested in selling them?
I wasn't interested.
So this has been a hobby and a labor of love for you rather than a career.
That's right.
And how long has it been now since you've stopped making pieces?
Oh, it's only a few months.
A few months.
Since I got sick.
So perhaps you might start up again, or...
I don't know. It doesn't look like. This kind of sickness doesn't go away.
I see.
Stays with you till the end.
Right. Has there been any of your children who have picked up any of your talent and carried it on, or...?
No. No.
So it was your grandfather to you, and...
Right. My daughter teaches children that are not so developed.
Mm-hmm.
And she teaches them some art and craft, but that's not exactly what I would call it.
And you've worked in copper, have you, or and steel?
Steel mostly.
Some plastic wood.
I have some copper work too.
And then the rooster you were telling me about, which is a rooster from your childhood, is that right?
I raised him from the very beginning until he became very big.
And then tell me a little bit about the silver pieces that you made.
It's just when I get tired working on the heavy work, I take some leftover or old forks and spoons and I make menorahs or playing and instruments and so on and so on. That's just for time passing.
Are these three pieces that you've shown me here, the two musicians and the menorah, are those the only ones of this kind, or are there other?
No, I had many more and I sold it, and I have some more in the closet.
Are they all the same sorts of themes?
Similar.
Give me some examples of some of the other things.
The other things, all musical, with musical instruments.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever played an instrument yourself?
No.
You've done a lot with musicians, wondered.
I like it.
You had some relatives who were musicians, did you? No.
No.
No, just musicians you remember then from...
Right.
Since so many of the themes of your pieces are about the life in the shuttle, why don't you just talk a little bit about them and about your memories then that these are bringing up?
The life of the shuttle was very, very interesting, but they're not in existence no more since the Holocaust. Why are they so interested, according to my opinion? First of all, because in a settle, all the people know each other, and they consider like if they would all be relatives. If there is a wedding, nobody sends anybody any invitations, but the whole settle is invited. A settle is a small village where people stopped a few hundred years ago, because in Poland and in Lithuania, the big cities were very far apart from each other, and the peasants couldn't get what they would needed to have, like from a small store. So these people stopped and formed a little village, a little town, and it was called a settle. And there they established everything what the Jewish people needed for to live in it, like a little synagogue and a cheder, that's a school, and that's the way they took care of each other. When something happened in the settle, everybody was interested in it and involved in it. So that if there was a wedding, everybody was involved. If there was the other way around, a funeral, everybody was involved. And the synagogue was the place where all the news used to come after the people used to come from the cities and from the villages where they used to go peddling. They used to come and tell all the different news that they heard, and that's instead of newspapers. That's the way the people knew everything what was going on.
Did your mother or your grandfather or anybody ever tell you stories like when you were, I don't know, like, you know, bedtime stories?
Oh, yes. We had a lot of stories. One story is that on the cemetery there was a bin where they make the honey, the bees make the honey on a tree. Now the Jewish people don't believe that that you are allowed to use anything that is in the cemetery. So the man in charge of the cemetery used to warn this peasant, Andrew, that he shouldn't take the honey from the tree because it's not allowed. But he wouldn't listen to him. And one time, a long time later, that's the way the story goes, after he kept on warning him and telling him not to use the honey, the old man that told him that was died. And then the next time, when the honey was ready, the peasant came up on the tree to take it, to take the honey, and somehow whatever he was carrying got stuck in the tree and he couldn't get off. And they found him in the morning dead from a heart attack. And everybody thinks that because the other man came to tell him that I told you not to take the honey and you're not listening, and I told you when I will die, I will not allow you to do it. And that's what happened.
Hmm. Is that a story that you heard from someone in your family?
Right.
Who would that have been, your mother?
My father and my grandfather.
Can you give me another one that they might have told you? Do you remember another one?
Another story? Well, that's what happened with myself, but I was only 2 years old. I didn't know. This is what my mother was telling me. When I was 2 years old, I was running around the street without shoes. And I stepped on a piece of wood that had a rusty nail on it. the nail got in the foot, and the doctors couldn't cure it from the infection. And finally, after 2 years that it couldn't be healed, they decided to amputate my left leg. My mother didn't want to do it, and she was fighting with the doctors and so on. That's the way my mother was telling me. At night, her mother came to a in the dream to her, and she told her, "My daughter, don't let him take off the leg from the boy. Go to this house in this street, in a certain street, to this house, and there will be a woman that will give you a medicine to cure it." My mother got up in the morning and went straight down there, and she found the house that her mother told her in the dream, and the woman gave her a medicine, a salve, and she started putting it on the foot, and it cured. That's the truth. That's the true story that my mother told me.
And you remember any others that your father or your mother told you, or is?
No, not offhand.
Not offhand. And tell me a little bit more about some of the characters again that you've, are the persons in the shadow that you, some of the figures here, the persons that, and you know, the life in the shadow that you were telling me about, some of the other figures. You said there was, like, yes, the woman over there selling...
Selling apples? Well, there were many women that married a man that was only sitting in the synagogue and studying the Torah. And he didn't make any money, so the woman had to go out and sell either apples or some other things and make a living for the children. That's one story. There was a water carrier in our town, and he was always teaching us. He was a very strong husky man, and he was teaching us not to be scared in a fight, but not to run. And he told us, when you run, they will run after you. But if you fight back, they'll be scared and they wouldn't touch you no more.
Mm-hmm.
There were all kind of stories like that going on.
How about some of the other people, some of the craftspeople or the shoemaker? Was that someone that you knew? Did he tell you stories?
Not very many.
Or the tailor?
Tailor. No, I can't remember myself.
And then some of the other figures in there were scenes from the yeshivas and from learning.
There was a lot of stories. In the yeshiva used to teach many, many boys. The boys used to come from all little towns around the big city. But they didn't have the money to pay for board, for room and board. So the yeshiva teacher collected volunteers, families that promised to feed a boy once a week. And some of them that could promise to feed him on Friday and Saturday. So this is the way they collected so many volunteers that it was enough for all the boys that were in the yeshiva that came from all different towns. The parents didn't have the money to send them to buy food. So they went and to eat. So let's say Monday in one house, Tuesday in another house, Wednesday in another house, and it was called Eating Days. Now in some cases, there were very nice stories in it. There was, let's say, a girl in a certain house where the boy used to come every week to eat her, and they fell in love, and they weren't supposed to. And when the father found it out, he wanted to marry her off to somebody else. So there were a lot of tragedies. Some of them even committed suicide, a lot of girls. And some cases where the boys didn't like the people in that house, they didn't give them, they didn't treat them right. In one family, they would say for the boy that comes to eat the best things they have. But some of them didn't. They only gave the boy the leftovers. And the boy didn't like it, so he didn't eat. So he was going around hungry that day. Stories like that.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we close with the story you were telling me before about the wedding dance or the handkerchief dance? Can you tell me about that?
Yes. The handkerchief dance comes all the way back from the time of the Spanish Inquisition. In 1492, the Jews were driven out from Spain. And the most of them went all over Europe wherever they could, but the learned Jews, the rabbis, went to Italy. And in Italy, they established themselves as an authority. And what happened is that the younger people came to the rabbis and they said, we have to do something not to lose our young people. Take a look, they say. The Gentile, the Italian youth, they go to school and after that they're free. They can play ball, they can play all kind of games in the streets, they can go in the evenings to athletics, to theaters, they can go with the girls. But the Jewish boys are not allowed to do anything of that sort. They, when they become 3-4 years old, they are taken to school to learn to read the Bible. And after that, they have to continue doing that all the time. They have to pray 3 times a day to go to synagogue to pray. In the evening, they are not allowed to go to see any theater or anything of that sort. Their life is very, is not interesting, and we are afraid they're going to lose a lot of young people. So the rabbis listened to them, and they told them, okay, I'll tell you what you do. You can start playing theater, but the topics of the playing has to be from the Torah, from the Talmud. And it shouldn't be boys and girls together or men and women together, only men. If they need anybody to look like a woman, they have to get dressed like a woman. Now, if they going to do that, then they'll be able to go and have fun. But as long as they're not going, mixing together men, boys, and girls. And that's why this year dance was created as a result of that, because they are not holding each other, they're holding a handkerchief in between them. And that's about 300 years old.
And what did you say the name of that dance was in Yiddish? It was
kosher dance.
Kosher dance.
Kosher dance.
And the other name that you gave me for it was
Volksdance.
And there was a third name?
That's a Hebrew name.
Which is?
Which is Bereges dance.
Bereges dance.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.